everybody. Welcome to our every once in a while art show. Once again, sponsored by the Friends of the KITP, and you're all friends, and curated and organized by our reigning artistic artist and genius in residence, I mean artist in residence, Jean-Pierre Hébert. And you know, I didn't see the show until about an hour ago, and I must say this is one of the most interesting we've ever had. It's really a pity that the place isn't full. So please tell all your friends who missed this that it's a great show and that it's open and that they're really missing something not to have come, and to tell their friends and so on and so on. And so even though this is a friends event sponsored by the Friends of the KITP, the show is open to everybody, and so many things go on in Santa Barbara, nobody knows about this gem, unfortunately. Or not enough people, so do spread the word around and tell people they can just come out here, walk into the building, nobody will stop them or charge them or anything. Mm-hmm. And there will be a little explanation up there eventually, right?
Yes.
So they just wander up there, they'll have a great hour, and then they can wander out. And so let's spread the word, because it really is a fantastic show, and I'm excited that we have all the artists who are going to tell us something about their art and how they do it and the secrets and something. Two are here, of course, Jean-Pierre and David M., and two are here virtually, which is almost as good. So I'm going to the mic to Jean-Pierre.
Well, this is the third or the fourth algorithm show that we have, and it now is something like a tradition. And the tradition is that I invite three artists that I have met alongside my career, and as long as they fulfill a condition, which is to do their work algorithmically. And so some of them are computer algorithms, and then some others are doing their work by hand. Some others are using their hand and or the computer at different time in their lives. But the general idea is that it has to be algorithmic. So this year, I had three guests, and one of them is with us. It's David. David will tell his own story, but it's a very interesting one, and he's doing very interesting work. There is Paul Hertz, who is from Chicago, and has done a number of his pieces by hand many, many years ago. And the last one is a surprised guest, and one day Dan Owen called me, and Jeffrey Stoppel from the math department was wishing to have Robert Lang come to UCSB because he was scheduled to possibly become the regent lecturer. And so we talked to him, and there was a couple of interesting misunderstandings between Robert Lang and myself, because you will see in the show that a number of his origami are definitely a mathematical subject. They deal with three-dimensional geometry and polytops and interesting things of the kind, but you also have a zoo of animals and birds and plants and the tortoise. And then I called him and I complained. I said, well, you told me you would send us 10 mathematical pieces and I see only two. And then he explained to me that even the most modest tortoise is actually conceptualized mathematically and programmed. And he sent me today, too late to be in the show, some of the diagrams that are the produce of his mathematical efforts and the base for the folding. But I got that too late to be able to install them. I will do that in the following days. So this is a mix that we have, and we'll start by David M, who is here next to me, and give him the mic. Then I will talk about my own work.
So thank you, Jean-Pierre.
Am I live?
You can put that on.
I could. All right. Can everyone hear me? Am I live? Am I Memorex?
You're not amplified, so you have to project.
I will project. Well, thank you, everyone, for inviting me up here. This is great. I recently was in a show with Jean-Pierre in Chicago, and I followed your work over the years and had no idea that you were in Santa Barbara, and had no idea that you weren't some kind of physicist person who also made some pictures. And so we got in contact recently, and I got a chance to visit you in your studio and see the work. And it's a thrill to be in a show together, because Jean-Pierre's work, there are other people who work in the same general medium, but I always recognize your work, and it's not generic. It's not of a generic nature, and I think that's one of the keys that makes this medium so difficult for a lot of people to understand. Oh my gosh, it's made with a computer. Does the computer does the work? Does the artist do the work? How does all of this happen? But the artist can insert themselves in any medium and manifest their consciousness. Jean-Pierre does that beautifully, and I think that's always been the challenge of this medium. So I don't have very much time, but I put together here a little slideshow. It's a slideshow of the same images that are on exhibit upstairs that hopefully you've seen, or if not, you will see. And I thought I would just talk a little bit about where each picture came from over time. And this was one of the first digital images that I ever made. This was 1977, and I had come to Los Angeles to I was invited to be the artist in residence at the Jet Propulsion Lab, which is a subdivision, you might say, of Caltech. And getting that lab up and going was a real story. I moved to LA in 1976 thinking I was going to start making pictures with computers. And a year and a half later, the lab was finally set up. I really didn't know if this was ever going to happen. It was that difficult. There was no such thing as personal computers. Personal computers were a concept at that time. It was something that people, smart people, people involved in technology, discussed, will we see personal computers in our lifetime? And most people said, no, we will not. And so the only way you could do this work was to hook up with some large, there was no such thing as commercial software. Things like, you know, Photoshop. I remember giving a talk at Caltech, actually, in the early 80s, it must have been, and a group of us went out for dinner after the talk, and we were on Lake Boulevard in Pasadena. It was about 11 o'clock at night, and we're walking up the street, and there was an egghead software. And all of us looked at it and went, my God, a store that only sells software. And it was a revelatory moment. It was, my God, look where we are, a store that sells software. So when this picture was made, there was no such thing as commercial software. Everything was one of a kind. It was handmade. It was working on systems that involved working in big institutions. You had to go through guard gates. You had to learn how to run the numbers to make a picture. And I was at a point where I was wondering if I would ever make a picture on a computer. And there's a kind of a backstory to that. I had been exposed to computers for the first time at the Xerox Research Labs, and I realized that the future of art is digital. There was no question in my mind. But Xerox, in their infinite wisdom, which invented, as many of you may know, everything that is what we know as computing today, the mouse, the graphical user interface, the ability to talk to printers, networking, everything was invented at Xerox Research Park. But Xerox didn't understand what they had. The folks who ran the business on the East Coast saw a bunch of long hairs in California doing something weird that they didn't understand. And so they never promoted it, and it took a guy named Steve Jobs to go and say, wow, this looks pretty cool, and he created a company called Apple to do this kind of stuff. So where I came into the picture was there at Xerox. It turned me on. Literally 2 weeks later, Xerox shut down their entire operation where they were creating the first color computer graphics picture on the planet Earth. And they said, we see no real world application to computer graphics. Cool. So I discovered the medium. The light was on in my head. There was nowhere to go with it. I went all over the United States. And everywhere I went, and there were only maybe 200 people doing this at the time in the U.S., and I said, who's doing it in California? And everyone would say, you ought to look into JPL. You know, they make pictures at JPL. They must be doing something. And so I went to JPL, and JPL, if you've never been there, is like a college campus. It's like this. It's huge. It's bigger than this. There's, you know, tens of thousands of people there doing rocket science and this sort of business. And I knew nobody there. I called the front office secretary and I said, I'm an artist. I'm interested in making pictures with computers. Is there anybody doing anything there like that? And she said, I'll look into it. I figured that's the end of that. But actually, she called back a couple of days later, and she said, you know, there's a mathematician here who's interested in the visualization of mathematical properties. He's willing to talk to you. And I talked, he was a guy named Al Shepke, and that was what he was interested in. He wasn't into this, but he said, there's a young guy here who's trying to get a graphics lab started. And I talked to him. Well, he was interested in art. We were having a little conversation outside earlier about, you know, why are certain people in the sciences and physics interested in art or not interested in art? Well, he was interested in art. He could talk about Van Eyck. He could talk about Van Gogh. He could talk. And he said, it would be great to have an artist here. And that's why I moved to Los Angeles and to JPL, thinking that this was all going to kind of happen, as everyone else did. But a year and a half went by, and finally, the fellow who wrote a lot of the original computer science programs to do this kind of thing came out from University of Utah. He set his system up, and one night when he first arrived, terrified that his system would ever not be running, he had taken the tapes off of the machine at Utah, gotten in a car, drove to Los Angeles to JPL, got out of his car, made sure that everything was running, and I looked over his shoulder while he was doing it, and then he went to his apartment to go to sleep. And that night I stayed up and I made this picture. So this was the first picture I made on that system. And after I made the picture, at about 3 a.m, I remember kind of looking out, wow, I made a picture, it finally happened. I realized I knew nothing about this system, really. I'd been working on other, I didn't even know how to save the picture. And so I taped a sign, I said, please save this picture, hoping it would still be there. And in fact, when I came in the next day, the picture was saved and everyone was there and they said, how did you do that. And that was where I was able to integrate with the environment, when they realized there was something I could do with the system that was beyond their ken, as what they did was in many ways at that time beyond my ken. And so we were able to find a place to work together to create how to make images with systems using this technology that had never existed before. This is an image, it's upstairs, and this is like, you know, jump ahead from 1977 to 1985. And there's so many things that changed during that period of time, one of which was that the systems that involved were a whole other place. There's not time to talk about that. But this was, in fact, Jean-Pierre asked me, how did you make this picture? And I had to think back, and it was funny because I don't remember how I made the picture exactly. I really don't. I just remember that it happened very fast. And what the quick story behind this image is, a friend of mine's grandfather, who was this old Spanish guy, he didn't speak English, he had come over from the old country, I'd kind of got along with him. And he passed away one day, and they asked me if I would come to his funeral, and I did. And on the drive back, these images came to me, very strong, very powerful, of this particular kind of space. And I drove right over to the JPL lab, and I sat down, and this came out the other end, 20 minutes later. It was quick, it was fast, it happened. And since then, I've been working on printing this image. It's turned out to be very difficult. The print upstairs, one of the first times I've been able to print it to where it's something that I was happy to show. This was also from that later JPL stage. This is like 1986. And I was interested in the evolution of images, the evolutions of shapes and forms. And so this was an early attempt at an artificial life approach to making images, where I was taking textures and mapping textures onto objects that became mapped onto further objects, so they were growing. So the idea here was to kind of grow images into one another. And at the time, we had such limited resolution. I mean, it's hard to believe. This, we had 500 pixels by 400 pixels was our limit. That was all you could do. And so I made this picture, and as an experience in motion and life, it was interesting. But as an image, I couldn't pull it off. It was because, you probably know about things like staircasing and anti-aliasing, and this thing was just like, you know, walking up some kind of ancient Assyrian staircase. But in the last few years, I've been doing a kind of personal archaeological project where I've taken early images that I did and figuring out how can I make them work today. And so I took this picture and I basically recalculated, remade it, reworked it to where it was an experience where we can see it on this scale now, and it pulls itself off. So that's been a very interesting thing, of having work that was produced, what is that, you know, on nearly a quarter of a century ago, but it took me until a year or two that I could finally manifest it. So these are works that were produced really over decades in terms of time span. This is the last picture I made at JPL, and I didn't appreciate it in many ways at the time. I was trying to create kind of an extension of what we were talking about earlier, forms that were alive and forming and morphing and creating a space for themselves. So it was a new sculptural space, a new environmental space. And at that time, the lab had been funded by a deep space projects that were visualizations, really for PR purposes, of the Voyager trips past Voyager and Saturn and that kind of business. When that funding dried up, our graphics lab funding dried up as well. And so suddenly there was like no lab anymore. No one was being paid. And it turned into a ghost lab. It was very eerie. It was like being on a space station in a science fiction movie. There were no humans. There were only the machines running. And I would still come in and I would make these images with them. And so this is the last one I made, and I really didn't quite get what I was doing in a sense, because this picture stayed on a disc for a couple of decades until a friend friend of mine, a programmer that I'm working on a film with, came by and I was looking at some pictures. And he said, wait a minute, let's look at that. That's an interesting image. And he started deconstructing it for me. So finally I pulled it out and I printed it, and it turns out that it has an audience of its own. So I don't always appreciate things when I make them. The process of doing is what drives it. This is a little later. This is when I finally started working with personal computers. So this is in the early 90s. I had been doing some consulting with some game companies, and they had problems paying me for the final work, which often happens when you do independent work. And so I called my lawyer and I said, what do I do? They don't want to pay me. Well, they had built a system for me. He said, why don't you just hold on to the system and keep it as an offset against what they owe you? So that's what I did. Eventually they paid me and I had to give it back, but meanwhile I had a half a year where I finally had a decent system of my own to work on. And so a whole body of work came out of that through an unexpected series of events. So these were really like the first personal computers that could do this kind of thing. This is actually, I'm a little out of order here. This was a little bit before that. I was an artist in residence at Apple's Labs for a while in the Advanced Technology Group. And this is really the first work I did with personal computers, where finally it was out of the lab and it was working on machines that human beings could afford. This was a Mac 2FX, really the first machine that you could sit on your desktop, it was a pizza box, and plug away with it, and stuff came out the other end that was believable. There's a lot of stories behind the series that this came from that we don't have time to get into it now, but that's from that. Here is later, I set up a lab in Sierra Madre, California, where we live in the basement of the old city hall, and this was working. I got very interested in chaotic dynamics and forces that are moving, so wind and gravity and all sorts of energies that are moving together in different ways. And so this was starting to work with pieces. This really is a piece that exists in motion, although once I got the thing working in motion, it would inevitably crash the machine, and I was lucky to get a single frame out of it at all. So this was beginning to work with dynamic forces of throwing energies into a scene and then extrapolating an image that came out the other end. This is from that same period, and here I was going back to a lot of my early roots. I was very interested in architecture when I was a kid, and at one time I conceived of myself as an architect before I got into this, and now starting to work with physical objects, lighting the objects, texturing the objects, creating things that could exist in the real world, and now with 3D printing, which there's some 3D printing going on here on the canvas, on the campus, there's the possibility of actually creating these as objects that can live in the real world, and we can see them in a material plane in a different kind of way. And then moving on to what I'm working with now, this is some of my most recent work, and I'm very interested in the idea of, a lot of this show is about printing, and so I've been printing prints for many years, but now for the first time I'm working with printing paintings, because this exists, the piece that's on show upstairs is a painting. It's on canvas. It has pure pigment applied to that canvas through a digital printing process, and that's coated with a wonderful acrylic coating on top of that. So technically speaking, it's a painting. There's no glass in front of it. It's the first digital paintings, not that were ever made, but that were made on a level that I feel can stand up to any other painting ever made from the point of view of what is a painting, what is a print, what is a work of art. So I'm really thrilled to be producing this. So this is this year, pretty hot off the presses. This is what I've been working with most recently. And so this is a frame from a long series that I'm working on. And this is kind of the scale, actually, that I'd like to see it on. I'm working with different ways of presenting the images, and scale is a very important aspect. So this is where I am now. So that's a quick journey through time and space, 1977. 2009, that's what I've been doing. So thank you, everybody.
I'm very thrilled to have David M. here, because time-wise we almost have had the same parcours, and not too long ago we were together in Chicago to attend an exhibit in which both of us were. And we had a talk from an artist that I hope to be able to show here next year. And his name is Manfred Mohr. And Manfred Mohr started actually a little before me and before David. And he had the problem of finding a computer to do his work. And what was interesting is that he was living in Paris, and he had the bright idea to go to the meteorological service of France. And he was allowed to use a computer at night. So during the day, they were doing weather forecasting. And during the night, all this nice equipment, including whatever was needed to make drawings of maps, was available to him. So this is how he could get started. About the same time, I already had the idea to use computers to make drawings. But differently, I was always convinced that to do work, you need to have the equipment in your own studio. You need to be able to access it night and day and work as often that is needed to produce something that is of good quality. And I never felt that it was possible to do that if you were not owning the system. So while David was using big computers at JPL, I had a very small HP computer with just a one-line display, and I could see one line of code at a time, and there was no graphic screen. I could only use a little thermal printer, and the images were fading in a few days. So I don't have anything left from this time but a few documents. So now things have changed a lot, and I just installed, not too long ago, a few days ago actually, one of these new Apple computer with a very wide screen, and it has four processors and 8 gigabytes of RAM and all that. And this is really has very quickly changed my work, and actually overnight I've been able to improve what I was doing, and I have always had this interest in drawing lines, because to me lines are the basis of drawing. And I want to draw lines of high quality, as thin as they can be, and I could really overnight improve everything I was doing because of the power of this this new computer. So historically, the context of working has totally changed because of hardware, because of software, because of quality of printers. What David showed us, the last image, is one of the reasons actually why I invited him, because it's so beautiful with all those colors perfectly rendered, greens and pinks and oranges that you could not almost see before. And so there is a bright future to produce visual art with computer, but at the same time, there is something that is strange that I feel is happening, which is that all this visual work is probably very soon fade into irrelevance, because now everybody has a computer, everybody has software. There is not a campus or a college or a community college in which you have dozens and dozens of students who learn the tricks of doing that. Epson is producing millions of nice printers that everybody can buy. I read that 2 years ago, 100 billion photographs had been shot over the earth by mankind. So there is an accumulation of visual material which renders everything that we're producing almost irrelevant and invisible, and disappearing within the web and the libraries and so on and so forth. So there is something new to find. And actually, my effort recently has been to try to find something at least new for me. And the funny thing is that as I was looking for that, I'm making even more pictures than I ever did before. And the way I am doing this work now is that over the last few years, I've been interested in the visual aspect of interferences between networks of lines. And I have worked on really that idea for the last 4 or 5 years. I have shown such work recently, quite a bit last year and here. And at the first show of The Algorist, I invited Chana Horwitz, who is a wonderful artist and does algorithmic work, but by hand, with pen and ink, and she does it the hard way. But a lot of his work is inspired by everything that happens when you create parallel system of lines. And as I was doing that about a year ago, I started to actually, instead of inputting angles between those lines manually in some kind of arbitrary way, I plugged my networks of lines into a clock. And so I had all those different squares filled with lines that were rotating as, you know, the hands of a clock. And it created all kind of very interesting things. So first I had the second, and I had the minute and the hour, and then I added the calendar. And then I had 6 levels of lines rotating at different speed. And interesting things came out. But then our son showed me a website where somebody had built a fractal clock. And I had been using fractals maybe 30 years ago when I first started to program. I was doing fractal geometry. And the idea of plugging a fractal system into the time, I thought was wonderful. And so I started to develop that and was very, very much surprised by everything that came out of it. And so now I have written this software that works in real time. You remember for the last Algorist show, I had invited Casey Rias from UCLA. Casey Rias was one of the developers of a system called Processing. He did that with Ben Fry and when he was at MIT. And so the systems allow someone to program and display images, sounds, whatever, in real time. And it's quite easy to program. It's free. It's available publicly, and I use that. And so now I can make images that move, which I could never do before because it was either too hard. I could do that on a Sun 25 years ago, but then Sun changed the operating system and it became so difficult that I always worked in different ways. So now I have this system that continuously creates images, and they are logically linked, they are dependent on time, and the beauty of it is that the software can never produce twice the same image because it's always a different time. I can also plug in the latitude and longitude, so wherever the software is run will produce a different image. I've been able also to plug it into different angles. For instance, I have a variation of it which is linked to the position of the moons of Saturn, and I have another one where I have plugged in the moons of Jupiter, and I'm looking to have the equations, and I'm sure I will find them here, of the entire solar system to create actually these networks of line. So once I had built this engine, I decided that I wanted to let it run and not control it, but at the same time use it to improvise and do other things, and those things are what you see upstairs. And what I have done, I have used my keyboard as a piano keyboard, for instance. I can access almost all of the keys, and each key is attached to a certain function. And with this function, I can change colors, I can introduce new objects, I can actually introduce text coming from wherever. I can change the color of the line, I can change the color of the shapes, I can change the density of the lines that come up. So I have an ability to to improvise totally with this system. And what is very interesting is that it actually, when I use it, it's breathing behind my neck. I have really to go and do it on the spur of the moment, because everything is changing in front of me, but I have a way to be able to influence it, to model it, and if I like it, to capture it and then to print it. So the whole thing is very exciting for me, and I have shown the process to my family and a few friends, and I'm not sure I can show it now because of time, and also because it might fail if I try to do it in front of a large audience. And what also is important is that as I run it, it creates images on the display, and these images are interesting, but I still have a deep love for works on paper, and so it's important at some point to capture what is so alive as this, these images, and put them on paper. And for that, I've been helped by two friends here, by Sandra and Harry, who directed me to actually use a very interesting oriental paper called Kita Kata. And also, I could use a wonderful printer that they have. And so the very delicate image that you see upstairs, I've been made on that paper with that printer. And I'm really grateful that I could use that. So thank you. Now we have two videos. We have a video from about 10 minutes by Paul Ertz, and we have another one by Robert Lang. And those two videos are very different. Paul Ertz is a very quiet man, and you will see he has his voice is very low and is a little bit boring, but what he says is interesting. At the other end of the spectrum, Robert Lang is a wonderful speaker, and the video that we have comes from a situation where all the good speakers are even better than usual. It's recorded in one of the TED conferences, and so it's very flashy and active. So now I'm going to run that. The software I use, but maybe I will dare to try it after the video. So the first is Paul.
Hello, my name is Paul Ertz. I'm an artist. I've developed a generative system which I use for producing my drawings, paintings, and prints that are on display at the Kavli Institute. These two-dimensional works reveal the algorithmic aspects of my generative system. The generative system also produces performances, musical compositions, texts, and interactive installations. It even embraces the creation of fictitious artists who produce other streams of work. Paul Ertz is also a fictitious artist, but fortunately, he shares his identity with me, so I can talk about him rather freely. The very first work in the generative system was a collage that I created from scrap metal, found on the beach in Provincetown in the summer of 1969, while I was studying painting at the Provincetown Workshop, an art school founded by Hans Hofmann. Its fundamental motif was that of a window or picture frame, which could be reduced to a square hole in a square. A little experimentation revealed that there were four ways of connecting the interior corners to the exterior corners in such a way as to partition the frame into five basic shapes. I gave each shape and each partition an evocative name. Eventually, I called the set of four different partitions the four ignotiles. The four IGNO tiles could be arranged into a 2x2 array following another rule. I used each tile once, and I enumerated the diagonal lines so that 12 of them, shown in green in the diagram, would be unique over the array. Tiles in each group could be permutated into 24 different orders. This 12-point solution, or IGNO quad, of four tiles allowed me to place rotations and reflections of the tiles into 8 different groups. Next, I looked for ways of building 4x4 arrays. The Latin square, an n-by-n array of n elements where no element is repeated in any row or column, gave me a basic rule. Over the winter of 1979 to 1980, while living in Spain, with a few insights and a good deal of brute force, I developed rules for four colorings of the IGNO quads. That is, colorings where each shape gets one of four colors and no adjacent shapes have the same color. The oldest work on display, Agua Barrecha de Mirrors, or Cascade of Mirrors, dates from this time. The coloring rules led to more complex ways of representing the Latin squares, Greco-Latin squares, and other combinatorial rules for multiple elements in square matrices. I developed other rules for altering the geometry of the tiling patterns I was generating. There were rules for dissolving shapes into one another, and rules for classifying and coloring the resulting shapes. New shapes beyond the initial classification emerged from the boundary dissolving. These included lakes and paths. You can see these in the early work, Islas, Islands, and in later works like Piosoñara and Criadero. Another type of shape is the diamonds that appear in Prairie, which is not in the show. Other experiments, which I still have to explore fully after all these years, involve the possibility of inflating the tiling patterns, replicating diagonal lines at a larger scale. Diamante and its companion piece that reveals its structure may give you an idea of how this would work. I was doing all this work without benefit of a computer, but certainly not without computation. I created a deck of 32 binary punched cards to help me create compositions. First, I did chance operations by flipping coins, but soon I saw other possibilities. The cards used in the performance Ignotus the Mage were originally an algorithmic tool for creating paintings. Instead of flipping coins, I roped my friends into playing the Ignotus game. They wanted something in return, so I told fortunes. Some people took me too seriously, so I devised a dysfunctional fortune teller who could only tell the present. I lay the cards out, and the participant chooses various piles that I pick up. I read the cards, cued by a system that combines Kandinsky's theory of the picture plane with old-fashioned mumbo-jumbo and cold reading. I collect the patterns and the voices and faces of participants to use in installations. Out the four coloring rules, I discovered that the IGNO tiles could also generate parametric spaces for musical composition and performance. The theatrical action Möbius Paths, performed by the theatrical group Tet in 1980, was the first performance I created based on the parametric spaces. It involved cutting up a large Möbius strip and reading the sliced up text on it. Domain, in 1983, was a graphical score performed by musicians associated with Fonos and the Universitat Nova in Barcelona. instrumentation, pitch class and sequence, large and small scale durations, and phrasing were all determined by the parametric spaces derived from a particular Greco-Latin square. In 1983, I also moved back to the States with my young family, to Chicago, where I soon enrolled in the MFA program at the School of the Art Institute and learned to program computers. I had hopes there would be a kind of magic theater where my intermedia system would take off. I'm still working on that idea. In 2004, I managed to charm the composer Stephen Dembski into collaborating with me on a project that used a similar parametric space as source material for a virtual world and a song cycle based on William Blake's Proverbs of Hell, Fool's Paradise. In Steve's able hands, this material, which I had always found recalcitrant, proved supple and surprising. Strategies of mapping and recombination have obviously served me well. As I said early on, I've even created four fictitious artists, Paul Hertz, an algorist, Alma de la Serra, a mathematician turned nature photographer, Daryl Luce, a figurative painter, and Juan Teodosio Pescador, stage name Ignotus, a dysfunctional fortune teller. I expect to map their styles onto one another, recombining them much as I have everything else. If these works on paper, created over some 30 years, possess an elaborate formal language in line with constructivist art of the 20th century avant-garde, I hope they also own up to a sly mischief, smearing formality with muddy meaning. In the wider scope of my work, of which these visual patterns are one manifestation, laying structure on structure, mixing media and modality, I aim for something akin to expressionistic excess. Complex systems arise from simple systems, and meaning canters in on the back of any sufficiently self-referential system. Or so the story goes. Shouldn't a sufficiently complex system be able to ask itself whether it should take itself seriously? Let the grand edifices slouch into ruin under the weight of their ponderous metaphysical ideas. Let us proceed with the giddy aplomb of a clown on a tightrope, stepping off into thin air, into the next moment, into the next epoch.
Paul is very interesting, and he has a very complicated life with all those personalities. And so now we're going to have the TED talk of Robert Lang.
Thank My talk is Flapping Birds and Space Telescopes, and you would think that should have nothing to do with one another, but I hope by the end of these 18 minutes, you'll see a little bit of a relation. It ties to origami. So let me start. What is origami? Most people think they know what origami is. It's this: flapping birds, toys, cootie catchers, that sort of thing. And that is what origami used to be. But it's become something else. It's become an art form, a form of sculpture. The common theme, what makes it origami, is folding, is how we create the form. Now, it's very old. This is a plate from 1797. It shows these women playing with these toys. If you look close, it's this shape called a crane. Every Japanese kid learns how to fold that crane. So this art has been around for hundreds of years, and you would think something that's been around that long, so restrictive, folding only, everything that could be done has been done a long time ago. And that might have been the case, but in the 20th century, a Japanese folder named Yoshizawa came along, and he created tens of thousands of new designs, but even more importantly, he created a language, a way we could communicate, a code of dots, dashes, and arrows. Harkening back to Susan Blackmore's talk, we now have a means of transmitting information with heredity and selection, and we know where that leads. And where it has led in origami is to things like this. This is an origami figure. One sheet, no cuts, folding only, hundreds of folds. This too is origami, and this shows where we've gone in the modern world. Naturalism, detail, you can get horns, antlers, even if you look close, cloven hooves. And it raises a question, what changed? What changed is something you might not have expected in an art, which is math. That is, people applied mathematical principles to the art, to discover the underlying laws, and that leads to a very powerful tool. The secret to productivity in so many fields and in origami is letting dead people do your work for you. Because what you can do is take your problem and turn it into a problem that someone else has solved and use their solutions. And I want to tell you how we did that in origami. Origami revolves around crease patterns. A crease pattern shown here is the underlying blueprint for an origami figure. And you can't just draw them arbitrarily. They have to obey four simple laws. And they're very simple, easy to understand. The first law is two colorability. You can color any crease pattern with just two colors without ever having the same color meeting. The directions of the folds at any vertex, the number of mountain folds, the number of valley folds, always differs by two. Two more or two less, nothing else. If you look at the angles around a fold, you find that if you number the angles in a circle, all the even-numbered angles add up to a straight line. All the odd-numbered angles add up to a straight line. And if you look at how the layers stack, you'll find that no matter how you stack folds and sheets, a sheet can never penetrate a fold. So that's four simple laws. That's all you need in origami. All of origami comes from that. And you'd think, can four simple laws give rise to that kind of complexity? But indeed, the laws of quantum mechanics can be written down on a napkin, and yet they govern all of chemistry, all of life, all of history. If we obey these laws, we can do amazing things. So in origami, to obey these laws, we can take simple patterns like this repeating pattern of folds called textures, and by itself, it's nothing. But if we follow the laws of origami, we can put these patterns into another fold that itself might be something very, very simple. But when we put it together, we get something a little different. So this fish, 400 scales, again, it is one uncut square, only folding. And if you don't want to fold 400 scales, you can back off and just do a few things and add plates to the back of a turtle or toes. Or you can ramp up and go up to 50 stars on a flag with 13 stripes. And if you want to go really crazy, 1,000 scales on a rattlesnake. And this guy's on display downstairs, so take a look if you get a chance. The most powerful tools in origami have related to how we get parts of creatures. And I can put it in this simple equation. We take an idea, combine it with a square, and you get an origami figure. What matters is what we mean by those symbols. And you might say, can you really be that specific? I mean, a stag beetle, it's got two points for jaws, it's got antenna. Can you be that specific in the detail? And yeah, you really can. So how do we do that? Well, we break it down into a few smaller steps. So let me stretch out that equation. I start with my idea. I abstract it. What's the most abstract form? It's a stick figure. And from that stick figure, I somehow have to get to a folded shape that has a part for every bit of the subject, a flap for every leg. And then once I have that folded shape that we call the base, you can make the legs narrower, you can bend them, you can turn it into the finished shape. Now the first step, pretty easy. Take an idea, draw a stick figure. The last step is not so hard, but that middle step, going from the abstract description to the folded shape, that's hard. But that's the place where the mathematical ideas can get us over the hump. And I'm going to show you all how to do that so you can go out of here and fold something. But we're going to start small. This base has a lot of flaps in it. We're going to learn how to make one flap. How would you make a single flap? Take a square, fold it in half, fold it in half, fold it again, till it gets long and narrow, and then we'll say the end of that. That's a flap. I could use that for a leg, an arm, anything like that. What paper went into that flap? Well, if I unfold it and go back to the crease pattern, you can see that the upper left corner of that shape is the paper that went into the flap. So that's the flap, and all the rest of the paper is left over. I can use it for something else. Well, there's other ways of making a flap. There's other dimensions for flaps. If I make the flap skinnier, I can use a bit less paper. If I make the flap as skinny as possible, I get to the limit of the minimum amount of paper needed. And you can see there, it needs a quarter circle of paper to make a flap. There's other ways of making flaps. If I put the flap on the edge, it uses a half circle of paper. And if I make the flap from the middle, it uses a full circle. So no matter how I make a flap, it needs some part of a circular region of paper. So now we're ready to scale up. What if I want to make something that has a lot of flaps? What do I need? I need a lot of circles. And in the 1990s, origami artists discovered these principles and realized we could make arbitrarily complicated figures just by packing circles. And here's where the dead people start to help us out. Because lots of people have studied the problem of packing circles. I can rely on that vast history of mathematicians and artists looking at disc packings and arrangements, and I can use those patterns now to create origami shapes. So we figured out these rules whereby you pack circles, you decorate the patterns of circles with lines according to Moore rules that gives you the folds. Those folds fold into a base. You shape the base, you get a folded shape, in this case, a cockroach. And it's so simple. It's so simple that a computer could do it. And you say, well, you know, how simple is that? But computers, you need to be able to describe things in very basic terms. And with this, we could. So I wrote a computer program a bunch of years ago called TreeMaker. And you can download it from my website. It's free. Runs on all the major platforms, even Windows. And you just draw a stick figure, and it calculates the crease pattern. It does the circle packing, calculates the crease pattern. And if you use that stick figure that I just showed, which you can kind of tell, it's a deer, it's got antlers, you'll get this crease pattern. And if you take this crease pattern, you fold on the dotted lines, you'll get a base that you can then shape into a deer with exactly the crease pattern that you wanted. And if you want a different deer, it's not a white-tailed deer, but you want a mule deer or an elk, you change the packing and you can do an elk. Or you could do a moose, or really any other kind of deer. These techniques revolutionized this art. We found we could do insects, spiders, which are close, things with legs and wings, things with legs and antenna, and if folding a single praying mantis from a single uncut square wasn't interesting enough, then you could do two praying mantises from a single uncut square. She's eating him. I call it snack time. And you can do more than just insects. This you can put details, toes and claws. Grizzly bear has claws. This tree frog has toes. Actually, lots of people in origami now put toes into their models. Toes have become an origami meme because everyone's doing it. You can make multiple subjects. So these are a couple of instrumentalists. The guitar player from a single square, the bass player from a single square. And if you say, well, but a guitar, a bass, that's not so hot. Do a little more complicated instrument, well, then you could do an organ. And what this has allowed is the creation of origami on demand. I mean, so now people can say, well, I want exactly this and this and this, and you can go out and fold it. And sometimes you create high art, and sometimes you pay the bills by doing some commercial work. But I want to show you some examples. Everything you'll see here, except the car, is origami.
The 2006 Mitsubishi Endeavor, with a powerful 3.8-liter V6 and available all-wheel drive, a mythic combination of beauty and beast. Mitsubishi, driven to thrill.
Just to show you, this really was folded paper. Computers made things move, but these were all real folded objects that we made. And we can use this not just for visuals, but it turns out to be useful even in the real world. Surprisingly, origami and the structures that we've developed in origami turn out to have applications in medicine, in science, in space, in the body, consumer electronics, and more. And I want to show you some of these examples. One of the earliest was this pattern, this folded pattern, studied by Koryo Miura, a Japanese engineer. Studied a folding pattern, realized this could fold down into an extremely compact package that had a very simple opening and closing structure, and he used it to design this solar array. It's an artist rendition, but it flew in a Japanese telescope in 1995. Now, there is actually a little origami in the James Webb Space Telescope, but it's very simple. The telescope is going up in space. It unfolds in two places. It folds in thirds. It's a very simple pattern. You wouldn't even call that origami. They certainly didn't need to talk to origami artists. But if you want to go higher and go larger than this, then you might need some origami. Engineers at Lawrence Livermore National Lab had an idea for a telescope much larger. They called it the eyeglass. The design called for geosynchronous orbit, 25,000 miles up, 100-meter diameter lens. So imagine a lens the size of a football field. There were two groups of people who were interested in this, planetary scientists who want to look up, and then other people who wanted to look down. But whether you look up or look down, how do you get it up in space? You got to get it up there in a rocket, and rockets are small, so you have to make it smaller. How do you make a large sheet of glass smaller? Well, about the only way is to fold it up somehow. So you have to do something like this. This was a small model, folded lens. You divide up the panels, you add flexures, but this pattern's not going to work to get something 100 meters down to a few meters. So the Livermore engineers, wanting to make use of the work of dead people, or perhaps live origamists, said, let's see if someone else is doing this sort of thing. So they looked into the origami community, got in touch with them, and I started working with them, and we developed a pattern together that scales to arbitrarily large size, but that allows any flat ring or disc to fold down into a very neat compact cylinder. And they adopted that for their first generation, which was not 100 meters, was a 5 meter, but this is a 5 meter telescope, has about a quarter mile focal length, and it works perfectly on its test range, and it indeed folds up into a neat little bundle. Now, there is other origami in space. Japan Aerospace Agency flew a solar sail, and you can see here that the sail expands out, and you can still see the fold lines. The problem that's being solved here is something that needs to be big and sheet-like at its destination, but needs to be small for the journey. And that works whether you're going into space or whether you're just going into a body. And this example is the latter. This is a heart stent developed by Zhang Yu at Oxford University. It holds open a blocked artery when it gets to its destination, but it needs to be much smaller for the trip there through your blood vessels. And this stent folds down using an origami pattern based on a model called the water bomb base. Airbag designers also have the problem of getting flat sheets into a small space, and they want to do their design by simulation. So they need to figure out how, in a computer, to flatten an airbag. And the algorithms that we developed to do insects turned out to be the solution for airbags to do their simulation. And so they can do a simulation like this. Those are the origami creases forming, and now you can see the airbag inflate and find out, does it work? And that leads to a really interesting idea. You know, where did these things come from? Well, the hard stent came from that little blow-up box that you might have learned in elementary school. It's the same pattern called the water bomb base. The airbag flattening algorithm came from all the developments of circle packing and the mathematical theory that was really developed just to create insects, things with legs. The thing is that this often happens in math and the science. When you get math involved, problems that you solve for aesthetic value only, just or to create something beautiful, turn around and turn out to have an application in the real world. And as weird and surprising as it may sound, origami may someday even save a life. Thanks.
In the beginning was a screen. Millions of us came together in a public place to understand the present, to see visions of the future, sharing emotions, sharing experiences that shaped our lives. Then there was a second screen.
Well, that's the end of the program. But,
Maybe you should ask maybe the question.
Yes. Questions for David or for me or absent?
Question for David.
Question.
David, do you use a lot of, still go out and search out other systems and stuff, or do you do everything at home and then send disks or?
Well, I do everything in my own lab now, which is very different than where I started out, but I'm always seeking other materials, stuff going on constantly from individuals, from companies, from sources all over the web. So it's a growing field. It started out very simple and now it's very complex. You know, people all over the planet, you know, all sorts of unexpected things. So we have a community now that has people doing things, and so I'm always searching for new materials and new sources.
So you said you were doing some film. A film, is that your own film that you've written?
That's my own film. I did a lot of films in the 80s and realized the film was very expensive and very difficult to make money. So I got out of it for a long time. But now machines are fast enough and efficient enough that I can start to get back into a lot of those ideas. There's actually some stuff going on here in the campus involving some film that I might do some work with as well. So we can do things now that before were, you know, if it took 8 hours to generate a single frame and you're going at 24 or 30 frames per second, that becomes a very daunting experience. Now that we can do things in closer to real time, the possibilities become real. So as the technology advances, the creative ideas we can explore go along with it at the same time. Yes?
Yeah. I have an observation about scientists and art. I started as an undergraduate in astrophysics at UCLA in 1958, and we worked with a Marchant calculator, and you learned pretty soon not to divide by zero. However, if you change the quotient in the divisor, you could work out rhythms, and there were 12-place calculators, so you could get dump-da-dump-dump-dump-dump pretty easily. But interestingly, in the early 60s, we got a 70-90, and a lot of grad students, of course, did work in programming and so forth, and they wouldn't be happy with just doing the problem. They had to experiment with a computer, and at that time it was $500 an hour, but they got away with it. And I think the first art that I saw from the computer was George Washington doing zeros and ones on 20-foot paper. And then finally, at Hughes Research Labs, we used the PDPA computer for program or controlling an ion beam machine. And people were able to program that to play Mozart, and you could hear it on the bus. It produced a sound. So this extension of machines by scientists into an artistic mode has gone back quite some time.
Yeah, I think the history of it probably goes back hundreds, if not thousands, of years of people experimenting. And you know, a lot of the story of our times is the division of this business between what is science, what is art, what is experimentation. And you know, the Renaissance is such an interesting period to look at, because when you were you know, young kid starting out and you wanted to make your name, you would get involved with a workshop, and that workshop was involved with serious engineering, like how do we raise big weights? That was a big deal in those days. But that was also how do we make a ground? How do we make, how do we deal with perspective? All those issues, optics, were things that one individual was expected to know, to be literate in their medium. And today we've like divided out into all of these very specific areas. So I think that the beautiful thing about the keyboard is that it brings all of these disciplines together. Whether it's art, whether it's science, whether it's architecture, whether it's music, all of these things can now become available to a unified mind. It doesn't mean everyone will be good at everything, but it means that we can turn a lot of those areas that have become incredibly black and white in my lifetime back into the gray areas that are probably more appropriate for true creativity and experimentation.
Question to both of you. Do you see the writing on Moore's Law for 30 years? Do you see it saturating? I mean, you want, Javier, you like very thin, delicate lines, right? Controls. You're reaching a point where you're beginning to be happy with what you have.
Yes, I begin to be happy, but I don't see any saturation. I think I can use much more. And I think pretty soon we'll have much more. You know, soon we'll be able to use the GPUs of computers for general computation and develop algorithms for them. And so I'll be able to have more lines, finer lines, and more complex algorithms that I can seize upon. Yeah.
Yeah, I'd say we're not there yet. You know, we're definitely getting to places. And I've always been jealous of, for instance, writers. Their problem was solved a long time ago. Text is really easy. You can get any computer made today or made 15 years ago, and you're completely taken care of. And musicians have also been in a more similar space. That took longer. Then you start getting into images. Images get really complex. And then you get into images that move, and they become extremely complex. And so it's very easy for me to break any computer that I've ever owned. Yeah, so there's still an area to go, but probably the day will come not that far from now when we're not dealing with that issue anymore. I think we are getting there. I think it's going to happen, and we'll no longer have to be jealous of the writers and the musicians of the world and say, hey, we're all just working in a creative space, not how the heck do we make it happen. But I can still spend many, many hours making a single frame of what I hope will be one frame out of many in a second that will add up to a minute, that will add up to many minutes to make that sort of experience. So we're not there yet, but man, compared to where we were before. You know, I look at the artists whose shoulders I think I stand on. I consider myself a second generation digital artist. There was a first generation, and when you think of people like John Whitney Sr. or Lillian Schwartz, you know, there's a handful of people who were doing these things on 4K machines. That's unbelievable. What drove somebody to do that on a system like that? And yet they had the vision. They saw where it was going to happen. So I have a huge appreciation of that first group of people who made it possible for folks like me to even consider doing something like this. And we're going to be in that space where hopefully all of that will just be history soon. But we're not quite there yet. But we're on the border of it. Yes.
So when you're making art or making these pieces, are you trying to go for something that looks algorithmic, or are you trying to go for something that looks more natural? I guess sometimes when you make things with algorithms, they come out with this very structured...
Yeah.
Look. Are you trying to ever...
I can only speak for myself. I think it would be different for every artist. And I think there's a huge pro put a huge con to dealing with that issue. And part of it is you do want to express yourself. I mean, there's so much digital art, computer art, technological art that's so much the same, where the system has completely taken over. And to me, really, what's the point? I can appreciate it intellectually. Can I appreciate it emotionally? Is it really art? You know, I have to ask myself that question. On the other hand, there's certain peculiar aspects to every medium. And this is true whether you're talking about watercolors, you're talking about oil painting, or you're talking about chalk, or you're talking about digital imagery. It's the nature of the medium that's like, oh, wow, look what it does. Look what it could, hey, this makes me think that. So most of my work, I don't think I could have done in any other medium because it suggested itself. It was all of its own nature. And if you try to force an oil painting to become a watercolor, it ain't going to happen. So you have to have a certain joy in the medium. And then when you immerse yourself in the medium, you're able to express yourself and you flow through the medium. And that's the challenge to where you and the medium become one. So I think it has its own beautiful aesthetic and magical properties. And that's the great challenge, not to be completely taken over by it to where it's, you know, you're just generally randomly creating numbers that anybody could have done. How do you express something personal, spiritual, through the medium? And so that's been a challenge, but for me it's always kind of been a very straightforward operation because there's always been the oh wow factor. And look at this, ain't this great? So it's a point well taken.
May I ask for the question?
Yeah.
For me it's very different. I don't really try to do something, but I feel that I am like a surfer carried by a wave, and the wave goes somewhere where it's simple to go, although I don't know how to surf. But I figure that that's the case. You can only go that way or that way or that way, and you cannot go upstream. And when you use algorithms, they can take you here or there, not somewhere else. And sometimes they create their own artifacts and you have to live with them. And you must just be guided by what you like and what you want to do.
Okay, well, this has been wonderful, all of it. And let's thank the artist.
I forgot something, which was to thank Colin, who has installed Jody Foulet's show and has been a wonderful person.